Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome everybody to this event, the 2024 Ian Black Memorial Lecture, A War Like No Other, Challenge and Change in Reporting Gaza. Warmly welcome. I'm Michael Mason. I'm director of the Middle East Centre here at LSE. I'm going to say a little bit about the format of tonight before I introduce our guest speaker. This event is being organised as part of the LSE's public lecture programme, hosted by the LSE Middle East Centre. If you're interested in the Middle East Centre, just go to LSE website. You'll see our pages there, and you can check out what we do. This is the first of our lectures as part of the new Ian Black Memorial Lecture Series. This lecture series has been set up as a memorial to a former senior visiting fellow at the Middle East Centre, Ian Black. And I wanted to say a few words about him first before I introduce our speaker. This is much missed colleague. I have, you know, kind of mixed feelings about this event because this is a wonderful celebratory event, and we're kind of recognising, appreciating, celebrating much of the ethos that Ian Black as a journalist represented. But at the same time, you know, we miss him a lot as a colleague in the Middle East Centre. Ian was a veteran Middle East journalist. Many of you here, I'm sure, will know who he is. He actually started off at LSE with a PhD in government. For 36 years, Ian was based at The Guardian as Middle East editor, diplomatic editor, and European editor. He reported and commented extensively on the Arab uprisings and the aftermath in Syria, Libya, and Egypt. Wrote a number of acclaimed and popular books, including The Arab Spring, Revolution, Rebellion, and a New World Order, Israel's Secret Wars, Zionism and the Arabs, 1936 to 1939, contributed to the Encyclopedia of the Modern Middle East and North Africa. His most recent book, something which has absolute relevance today, and if you don't know this book, please go out and look at it. It's a remarkable book, Enemies and Neighbors, Arabs and Jews in Palestine, 1917 to 2017. So Ian joined the LSE Middle East Centre as a senior visiting fellow back in 2018. Actually, it's when I joined, I became the director of the Middle East Centre. He was actually, I was sitting next to him at one of our first events, and it was an event on Israel's new nation state law, if I remember, back in October 2018. And Ian was sitting next to me, and I was quite new to the job. And I saw this chap after the end of the lecture from the guest putting his hand up vigorously to ask to be selected to speak. And I saw Ian looking at me, next to me. He's sort of, I couldn't quite see what he was trying to communicate. I found afterwards, it was do not pick this person, do not pick this person. Unfortunately, I did. And the person, you know, we let them speak, and but then they were a little bit disruptive, but we got through the meeting, and Ian said to me afterwards, I could have told you who that was. And many a time after that point, Ian told me who somebody was, who a source was. I often went to him. He was an incredibly wise counsel, not just for me, for colleagues across the Middle East Centre, and we do miss him. And we're very, very pleased to have this new series in celebration of Ian. And I'm very, very pleased to say that Ian's family have been very supportive of this, and they're here, of his family here. Helen Harris, particularly, and Nina Rebecca, Ian's daughters, have been wonderfully supportive of the Middle East Centre in setting up this memorial lecture series. So our thanks are to you to allow us to use Ian's name in this way. Let me pass to our guest. Our guest is very fitting because it's somebody who knew Ian, and somebody who was also visiting a senior visiting fellow at Middle East Centre, and you overlapped, I think, a couple of years with Ian, and that's Jim Muir. Jim is a British journalist, formerly the BBC. He's lived and reported on the Middle East since 1975. He's covered the Lebanese Civil War, Kurdish uprising against Saddam Hussein in 1991. He moved to Cairo as BBC Middle East correspondent in 1995, then Tehran, where he chronicled the election of the former President Khatami. He covered the 2006 Israel-Hezbollah war and spent time in Iraq until the Arab Spring, providing much of the BBC's Syria coverage. And we're very, very appreciative of Jim delivering this inaugural lecture in the Ian Black Memorial Lecture Series. Before Jim starts, let me give you a bit of a running order for tonight. Jim's going to talk. We've had some discussion about how long to talk for. We reckon it'll be about 30, 35, perhaps 40 minutes, followed by questions and answers. At 7:30, we move outside. We have a reception. So I'm sure there'll be lots of questions. If you don't get a chance to ask your question in this, in the lecture theatre here, there will be opportunities outside to continue the discussion. And that reception lasts till about 8 o'clock. I should let you know that, as with all public events at LSE, this event is being held in accordance with LSE's Code of Practice on Free Speech, which protects and promotes freedom of speech and academic freedom. We intend for this event to be an engaging and critical discussion of current developments in the region, and there'll be ample time during the Q&A for further discussion. I know I would ask, if you do have questions, please wait until the Q&A rather than trying to interject during the lecture. This event is being recorded. We aim to make a podcast recording of the event available afterwards. Most Middle East Centre events are recorded, and if you go to our web pages, you'll see podcasts, audio and or video podcasts of our events. Please put your mobile phones on silent to avoid disrupting the event. If you are into tweeting about the event, the hashtag is hashtag LSE Middle East, one word. In the event, this is very comprehensive, by the way. In the event of a fire, very important, the assembly point is the entrance to Lincoln's Inn Fields directly opposite this building. Okay? That's all of the format and for the time being. So please, can you join me now in welcoming Jim Muir to the LSE?
Well, thank you very much, Michael. That's a very warm welcome. I'd like to start with a show of hands, if you please. Could anybody, all of you who knew Ian personally, put your hands up? That includes me. Ooh, lots. Yeah, great. Well, family of Cluj, of course. Rough acquaintance. The reason I ask is just to know how much you knew him. Michael's already said quite a lot about him, but when I was asked to do this talk, I felt sincerely honoured, and that's something people say as a kind of truism, but it's absolutely true. For me, Ian was kind of, not exactly a cult figure, but he was certainly a role model, because he was deeply grounded on the academic side of things, and yet he had crossed the bridge to become a journalist like the rest of us. I regard myself as slightly academic, by the way, and that's why I appreciate so much the fact that he was so well grounded in the academic world. He could have been an academic, he could have stayed there, but he wanted to experience real life, so he crossed that bridge and became... is that funny? and became a journalist, and an extremely good one, and all the better for having that. You know, when you read a piece by Ian, first of all, he never wrote a boring piece. That's a very big plus. And it was, you always knew that it was speaking with authority, because he knew what he was talking about. He was academically far more than respectable. Michael told you the list of books that he wrote, many of which were actually focused on this struggle over Palestine that's been going on for over a century. And he had, you know, he had that down absolutely pat. There was another way in which he had this sort of quality of bridging, and that was this. He was born Jewish, as you may or may not know, but that didn't colour, that maybe gave him an interest in the Middle East, but it didn't colour his judgments on the Middle East. He learned Hebrew early on in his career, and then he took up Arabic as well, and he became a very accomplished Arabist. I'm told by Helen that when in Paris, Arab taxi drivers would be amazed that he spoke French with an Arabic accent, which is quite something. So, yeah, he was funny, talented. If I'm thinking of my image, I was going to actually have a set of things where I ask you all to close your eyes and just summon up your images of Ian. Don't bother, you might fall asleep at the same time. But to me, he was always, if I'm imagining him in my mind, he was always either laughing or smiling. He saw the funny side of things, but at the same time, very intense, very focused, absolutely wrapped in what he was doing. He didn't care if his hair was all looked like he'd been dragged out of bed, that kind of thing. He didn't care about his appearance, did he? No, you know that very well. But this is his way of bridging between the Arab world and the Israeli world, which was quite, you know, I can't think of any other journalist who was fluent in Hebrew and in Arabic, which gave him insights and also empathies on both sides of this divide, which has now become so great and so toxic as a result of the events of the last year, which of course nobody could possibly have predicted. And I'm sure Ian would have had a huge contribution to make, given the fact that he had so much experience, knowledge, understanding of both sides of this toxic divide that we see now. As I say, he could have been an academic. He joined journalism after 36 years, was it, with The Guardian. He then came back here to the LSE and became a senior fellow. I remember attending one of his talks where he was launching a paper on the burgeoning relationship between between Israel and the Arab states of the Gulf, which was a real eye-opener to me. I wasn't completely unaware of that. It culminated, of course, later in the so-called Abraham Accords, but he was just so much ahead of the field on that. Then, of course, he started to become ill, and that was terrible. He kept up a bit of journalism. He was doing a question and answer session with a TV station, and suddenly became aware he couldn't answer one of the questions. He was kind of blocked. That was the first sign that something was going wrong. Then when he was out running, he fell over and didn't put his hands out to protect himself. He realized things were going wrong. He was diagnosed eventually with this horrible thing called FTLD, which I'd never heard of before, and which is a degenerative brain thing where you just basically start shutting down very, very painfully and slowly. But typical for Ian, he wrote an article about it in The Guardian with Helen. And that, of course, was very, very touching and moving, and all the more so because it was completely lacking in any kind of self-pity. He was writing about it as a journalist, describing what he was going through. And that made it all the more moving, I think. And of course, then he left us just a few months after that. And as I say, I think the world is so much, obviously people miss him for so many reasons, personal reasons, professional reasons, but above all, it was his ability to see both sides of this story, which has become so much more toxic since he died. So he's missed hugely for that, for the insights that he would have brought to this very, very polarized situation that we have now. So obviously we're now going to start looking at that situation. But before we get into the details of what's actually happening now, I'd like just to talk a little bit about war reporting. So we have a sort of baseline to look at why this war is so extraordinary and so unusual. I'd also like to say I'm not a war reporter. I'm a correspondent, Middle East correspondent, who's inevitably got caught up in the various wars that have happened on my patch. And I don't think Ian would have regarded himself as a war correspondent, would he? No. We're correspondents who cover the Middle East and who get obviously involved in covering wars. In my view, there's no one best way of covering a war. All contributions are valid, some perhaps more interesting than others, but you can cover the war on the ground, which almost often means getting embedded. It depends on what war it is. Every war is a bit different. But in a straightforward state-to-state war or army-to-army war, you almost always have to be embedded or have some relationship with the troops that you are with. And of course, like for example, in the invasion of Iraq in 2003, practically every news organization had at least one crew or correspondent embedded with the American forces. And that was regarded as normal, even though, of course, you're showing one side of the war, one slice of the war. You're not trying to cover the whole thing. In my case, for example, in Lebanon, I got caught up in a different kind of war, a civil war, where there was not just two factions with a clear-cut line between them. There was about 18 different armed groups, no clear often no clear dividing line between them, or that was constantly changing. So again, you have to have some sort of relationship with the forces on the ground, because you can't just turn up to a battle with no accreditation or know that you could be a spy, for example. So you run into a lot of trouble. So you have to have at least, you know, a piece of paper or some kind of credentials, neutral or preferably the side that you're trying to get through the checkpoint of. And if you show the wrong side, you might be in trouble, the wrong kind of papers. So that's on the ground. You can do pieces which are colourful, which show a slice. And war coverage to me is like a stained glass window or a kaleidoscope, where each contribution is valid, but it's a piece of the story. And it could be a colourful piece, or it could be something a bit more bland. I did a lot of sort of war reporting, but also a lot of pull together stuff where you're trying to cover both sides, where you're sitting somewhere neutral. The Iran-Iraq war, for example, I did a lot of putting together stuff from the Iranian side and the Iraqi side and trying to show where the whole thing was going, which you can't do if you're just on a battlefront somewhere. So you're doing something that is trying to give a big picture. It may not be very colourful, but it's informative and it's important because it's showing the direction things are going. So that is kind of the baseline, if you like. Now let's look at the situation we have now after the 7th of October last year. I think from the very first moment, it was clear that this was going to be a war like no other. It was going to be exceptional because of what happened on the morning of the 7th of October. I immediately thought, this is Israel's 9/11. In fact, time's a considerable factor, because it was, for the Israelis, much more than 9/11. It was not just the number of deaths, which was, for Israel, staggering. I mean, nearly 1,200 people killed in one day was the bloodiest day in Israeli history. It was also, that was bad enough, and much bigger proportionately than what happened on 9/11 in America. But kind of worse than that for the Israelis was the kind of national trauma that it brought out. Partly the fact that, partly it evoked memories of, for many people, the pogroms and the Holocaust and all of that, which that's baked into the DNA of many Israelis. So suddenly this was all brought back to them in a very vivid way. There were massacres, the people were being slaughtered. But also the whole feeling they had, their security came from the feeling that, yes, the Israeli army is the most powerful by far in the region, no question about it. Israeli security is supposed to be fantastic. Israeli intelligence was supposed to be great. The border defenses were state of the art. You know, suddenly, all of that is broken. And you have people rampaging around. There was massacres. There were terrible things that happened. So for many Israelis, their whole world was being shattered, and they were made to feel deeply, deeply insecure. I think on the Arab side of the whole divide, there's very little understanding of how traumatic that was. I mean, they think, well, we've been massacred many times, you know, since 1948, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't think they fully grasped the really deep trauma that this represented for many Israelis, and that is going to be a continuing issue. So from the beginning, it was clear Israel was going to react extremely violently, because the army felt it had been, that its whole, it had to redeem itself militarily, and also to get revenge. There was a very vengeful air. So of course that started. You had very, very heavy bombing for a whole month of Gaza, followed by the ground invasion and fighting and all that. It was immediately apparent to the Western press they had a major issue, and that was, how do you cover a war to which you have no access? The Israelis do not allow independent journalists to go into Gaza, so there was no Western press coverage from Gaza at all. That was a very, very major challenge. There were various ways of trying to deal with it, none of them terribly satisfactory. The Israeli army doesn't basically do embeds in the sense that we think about it, but on three or four occasions, I think they took journalists into Gaza under very tight control. What they could see and film was very much controlled. In a way, it sort of backfired a bit on the Israelis, because for example, they took journalists to the Shifa hospital, which they've been saying for ages had got Hamas's command and control center underneath it. And the Israeli spokesman was sort of moving aside expensive medical equipment, saying, look, there were like two Kalashnikovs, you know, which doesn't add up to a command and control center by anybody's stretch of the imagination. And there were other embarrassments too. They took the journalists to, they showed a thing on the wall. which they said was a roster for people guarding hostages, where in fact it was just in Arabic. There was just an empty calendar with the dates and months and things, or days of the month, written on it. And CNN swallowed that. They wrote a story saying they got it wrong and a bit of egg on the face. So those things were very, very limited utility, these mini embeds, you could call them. But I would still defend them because, you know, the journalists are seeing something at least. They may get a flavor of what the Israeli thinking is, for example. They can see the level of destruction. They weren't allowed to talk to any Palestinians about what they were seeing and so on. So it was still perhaps 5 or 10% useful compared with having free access to Gaza. Just to show some of the complications that can arise, more recently they did another mini embed for journalists based in Israel, taking them across the border into Lebanon, into South Lebanon for the first time, just like 2 miles across into a village which they weren't allowed to name, which had been occupied and quite badly damaged during fighting and possibly demolition and so on. Now that again, it was a kind of useful trip. You could see, I think they actually were able to interview Israeli commanders in the field, etc. It was useful enough. But when it hit the airwaves, and all the major news agencies were there, but for some reason, Hezbollah in Lebanon saw the BBC first, or regarded it as the most important, so they put out a very vitriolic statement denouncing the BBC, not content with colluding with the Zionist enemy, they're now sending people into occupied territory, blah, blah. So they were furious, and they withdrew the credentials of BBC and other correspondents working in Lebanon trying to cover the war on that side. So that had, you know, quite a major repercussion. I think that has now been eased a bit, so they're now cooperating, and correspondents there do need Hezbollah, because public sentiment in the Shia community in Lebanon is really ferocious, and foreigners turning up without a Hezbollah escort are likely to get into deep trouble. So Hezbollah is kind of acting in a kind of embed role, if you like, coming along and actually easing the task of journalists and who actually wouldn't actually be able to go there without that escort. So there we have it. There's very limited access, very big problems getting access to the story. Let me just get to my little notes here so I can not lose my drift, which is my big fear. So there are other workarounds where you can do decent, valid reporting without necessarily being in Gaza. Now, I'm calling this hybrid reporting. Jane Corbin, for example, of Panorama, for the anniversary last month, did a very nice piece where she focused on two Israeli families in a kibbutz who'd suffered horribly from what happened on the 7th of October last year, and then also focusing on two Palestinian families. And she managed to get footage, you know, shot inside Gaza by independent or freelance correspondents, videographers there, and get the tape out through, or get it through, transmitted by satellite, through the internet. So she put together a very nice piece that worked quite well. Channel 4 also had a very good piece about that horrible story of Palestinian prisoners from Gaza being basically raped and molested in Israeli captivity. They did a very credible piece, filmed, you know, in mainly in Israel, but also with input from Gaza, slotted in, kind of commissioned from freelancers in Gaza, transmitted by internet and worked into the story. That worked very well. And you can even do, there was an Al Jazeera investigation of what actually happened on the 7th of October, a one-hour documentary, which was also carried by a thing called Double Down News. It was pretty unbiased, but it kind of demystified quite a lot of the tales about what happened on the 7th of October. And that was done entirely in Israel with Israeli sources, and a really good piece. But all of this, of course, doesn't equate to what you would be able to get if correspondents were allowed into Gaza to do the story. I mean, it would make so much difference if the big TV stars could be there saying, look, this is what is happening. That would have a huge impact. So now the obvious source of help for the foreign press who are stuck outside are the journalists inside Gaza. who've been doing an amazing job and a very courageous job. For example, we're going to talk about social media in a minute, but Al Jazeera, for example, has been doing what you call conventional or terrestrial journalism rather than social media stuff. And from the very beginning, they've been doing around-the-clock live coverage. They've covered countless immediate aftermaths of Israeli strikes, countless images of bodies being carried into hospitals, laid on the floor because there's nowhere else to put them, and so on. They've done an amazing job, and I'll talk about the price of all that in a minute. But the social media has really erupted from Gaza. I wouldn't say that's necessarily a new phenomenon, because in the Syrian war, starting in 2011, the social media were absolutely vital, because before that, the Assad regime had managed to completely suppress major events, like in the north of the country. I'm talking about the 80s and 90s. They could completely control and suppress it, but once social media were available, as soon as anything happened, you'd have reports coming out on the internet and spreading like wildfire. So social media played a very important role there, but I'd suggest that in Gaza, it's been even more important. It's not like they invented new platforms, but I mean, you're still TikTok and all the rest of them. But the very heavy use, and obviously providing a resource that the outside media, the mainstream media, could actually use, as they could use Al Jazeera footage. So this was immensely important and hugely impactful. I mean, many people, especially young people in the West, their main source of news became the news coming out, the postings on video blogs, etc. By especially young people in Gaza, desperate to get their story out, and that became hugely important and very, very influential. One wonders, for example, if the Columbia University and other campus unrest would have happened had they not had input from social media. If they've only been getting New York Times and Washington Post and the networks, they probably know very little about what was going on. Now, obviously, social media has drawbacks. You can get fake news that goes around. There was a situation, for example, where there was videos going around, video footage of women soldiers butchered, but then in fact they came from, they'd been butchered by the Turks or killed by the Turks. And they were Kurdish fighters, nothing to do with Gaza at all. So you've got to be really careful. But eventually the truth tends to come out. If there's something that's visibly fake, then it does usually get unmasked. The phenomenon of social media is obviously extremely important. I have some reservations about it, because I'm never quite sure whether there's been a huge amount of it and a lot of very good information and images coming out. But I'm wondering sometimes whether this is not actually, because of course you're a counter, this is the same thing happening from the Israeli side. I'm wondering if this isn't actually a way of reinforcing the bubbles that people are living in over this story. Also, I'm wondering how many people have actually had their minds changed by what they saw on social media, or whether it's been simply reinforcing their own beliefs. I think these are things that need some study and haven't really been looked at very closely. But I want to talk a little bit about the cost of this, of being a journalist in Gaza, which is, and in Lebanon indeed, which has really obviously become much more of a story in the last month or two. According to the Committee for the Protection of Journalists, or to Protect Journalists, which is a very respected body and is quite restrained in accusations it's made, I think it's 134 journalists have been killed in Gaza and some in Lebanon as well. Now, that figure is enormous compared with, for example, if you take the entirety of the Second World War and the whole of the Vietnam War, more journalists have been killed in Gaza in 1 year than have been killed in both those, the totalities of those wars. So, comparatively, it is a very, very high figure. Now, Israel has been accused of deliberately targeting journalists, and there are certainly cases documented very carefully where that does seem to be the case. Some of them were obviously collateral damage, if you want to call it that. They weren't being deliberately targeted, but some apparently were, and I can give you chapter and verse on that in detail if you want. But the cost also, I mean, the cost is very high. Let's just look at Al Jazeera itself, for example. Their bureau chief, Wael Dahdouh, was on every day, day and night, for the first 2-3 weeks of the war. He was on camera, on live, when he got the message that his wife, his young teenage son, his daughter, and his grandkid had just been killed in an Israeli airstrike on his home. He continued broadcasting, and he kept it up after that. Nearly a couple of months later, he himself was wounded in the arm when he was hit by a rocket strike, which killed his cameraman, who was left to bleed to death because no ambulance could get there under fire. Not long after that, another son, who was older and who was a journalist, was in a car with another journalist and was hit by an Israeli rocket strike. That one in particular, the Committee of Protect Journalists deemed to be a murder, not just collateral damage, not just something that happened. It was a murder. Similarly, in Lebanon, very early in the war, just about 10 days into the war, Issam Abdallah, who was a very much loved and liked Reuters cameraman, was with a group of other journalists on a hilltop overlooking on the Lebanese border, looking over into Israel, where they could see, they're very clearly in view of at least 3 Israeli positions. They had an Israeli drone going around over them. They were in clearly marked press things on their chests, flak jackets, and their car was clearly marked press. There was no combatants in the area. There'd been no fighting in the area. There'd been some shelling across the border. Suddenly, they were hit by tank fire. One tank shell came in, killed Issam Abdallah. Another one came in 30 seconds later. And Christina Assi, who was a photographer of the AFP, had life-changing injuries. I mean, she was shouting, screaming, I can't feel my legs. You know, basically, she lost one leg and had the other one very badly damaged. So she is now still, you know, under treatment. So that was investigated exhaustively by Reuters itself. It was very slow to make accusations, but it did an exhaustive and very in-depth investigation, as did UNIFIL, the UN forces, and the Journalists Without Borders, and to at least 2 other major investigations. All of them concluded this was deliberate tank fire from the Israelis on clearly marked journalists. Again, it was classed as murder because that was it. You know, there was no other explanation. They were deliberately targeting people clearly designated as journalists who were behaving normally, milling around, they had cameras and so on. So these are the kind of risks that are involved in trying to cover this. It's a huge challenge. The big challenge, especially for the young journalists on the ground in Gaza, is simply to stay alive, to be able to tell the story. You know, that's massive. I want to talk a little bit about another way in which this war has been very different, and that is the level of technology that the Israelis have been deploying, which enables this kind of killing that we're talking about. Who in this audience can put their hand up and say, if they know in this context, what lavender is? 1, 2, 3. Ooh, well done, some of you. Yep, good. Lavender is a system adopted by the Israeli military intelligence unit 8200. It's a system whereby they feed every scrap of data they have into a powerful computer, and then artificial intelligence basically sorts out a list of targets, i.e. people who it deems worthy of assassination. In the early days of Gaza, it produced 37,000 names. Now, a human being only looks at each of those names for about 20 seconds, according to a report in a magazine called Plus, the dialing code for Israel, was it? 972, thank you very much. It had an exhaustive article which has never been debunked by the authorities. Now, a human being only looks at those targets for about 20 seconds. There's no examination of the data on which those decisions are taken. So they're basically taking a computerized list of and approving it. So many, many people were killed. And what is terrible is that if it's a low-level operative, Hamas operative or Hezbollah operative, who's been singled out, they're allowed to kill between 15 and 20 collateral damage, other people, in other words, their families. And if it's a higher value target, it can be 100 or more. And the default mode is to hit these people when they're in their homes, not when they're out fighting, which is slightly ironic because Israel's always accusing Hamas and Hezbollah of using civilians as human shields, and yet they wait till they're in their families before they get them. That at least several journalists who were killed in their homes, and many, many suspected Hamas people. Equally disturbing, these machines are 10%, have a 10% fault in them. I mean, they produce, the list of people they produce includes 10% of people who shouldn't, by their own criteria, have been singled out for assassination, yet it just goes ahead. Also, another equally horrible thing, because it's cheaper, they use not smart bombs to hit them. In other words, they're demolishing whole buildings or whole areas where they could have used much more expensive smart weapons, which would take out just that individual and the people immediately around him. So these are the kind of technologies that's now being deployed. And I've been absolutely stunned by the wider technology that the Israelis have at their disposal. They can be killing a couple in a car on coming down the coast road in Juni, opposite Juni in the Christian area north of Beirut, hitting a flat in Damascus where there's a suspected Hezbollah or Iranian Revolutionary Guard person, bombing Gaza, bombing the southern suburb of Beirut, maybe doing something in Yemen. All of these things happening simultaneously. There was a film recently called something like Everything, Always, All the Time or something. What was it? That sort of title reminded me of what the Israelis are doing. The technology is absolutely stunning, really, that they can do all these things at the same time. And often, I mean, they can take out like a PFLP guy you've never heard of in the south of Beirut, and at the same time as hitting something at a camp in the north of Lebanon and hitting somebody in Syria or Iraq, whatever. It's just amazing, the technical capabilities. I don't know if you've read Anthony Loewenstein's book called The Palestine Laboratory. It's very well worth reading because it shows how the Israelis are actually testing all these weapon systems and new technologies and computerized stuff and so on. So they can then sell it on to the rest of the world. It's a part of the export thing. I've also just been stunned, as I say, by the whole technology thing. It's just as a general observation, I'd say that in the war of 2006, which I followed very closely, spent the whole month down in the south, I was stunned by how stupid the Israelis were being. You know, they really were doing things that, having been involved in South Lebanon since the mid-70s, they should have known better, really. But in fact, they were making mistake after mistake. And in the end, they sent, at the very end of the month of the war, they sent tanks in and got practically massacred in an ambush. So they limped away from that war, obviously not beaten, because you can't beat a superpower, which Israel is in comparative terms. But they'd been humiliated by Hezbollah, and Hezbollah had sort of won. The problem for Hezbollah since then, that the Israelis have been playing catch-up ever since. They've been planning for what's happening now. Technologically streets ahead, and Hezbollah has been trapped in the mentality of 2006. They're still thinking, oh, they'll come in and we can get them with our RPGs and so on. They haven't really moved on, whereas the first signal of how advanced the Israelis have become was that horrendous issue of the exploding pagers and walkie-talkies, which, if you lay aside any moral or ethical considerations, which are probably quite great, or should be, and the Israelis themselves have never actually admitted to doing that, possibly because they're aware that there are moral and possibly legal implications. But as a military move, it was stunning. When people manufacture anti-personnel mines, they don't make mines that kill you. They make mines that maim you. And that's what all these walkie-talkies and things did. They blinded people. They blew their hands off or part of their hands off or maybe crippled their waists, which is much better from a purely military point of view than killing them, because they're out of the battle anyway, but they're going to have a huge amount of resources if they've been maimed or harmed rather than killed. So it was a kind of very cynical, but it was a masterstroke militarily, because it took out of the, I can't remember the exact figure, was it 1,500 or 2,500, but an awful lot of Hezbollah fighters or operatives were taken out of commission and had to be rehabilitated. Now I'm going to have to speed up, it seems, because they've already done 30 minutes. So we talked about the high-tech stuff. I wanted to just talk about how this war has also affected the Western media, what happened on the 7th of October, and especially the kind of things that turned out not to be true, like the thing about beheaded babies, which Netanyahu continues to talk about beheaded babies. There were no beheaded babies. there were no babies burned in ovens, there were no babies pulled out of their mothers' wombs and killed. That just simply didn't happen. Yet those are the things that made headlines around the world, and still do. And Netanyahu just last week is talking about beheaded babies again. It just didn't happen. There's no evidence whatsoever to support it. The rape issue is more complicated, but certainly there was. People have done investigations. The Times did one just the other day. What I want to get to through this is to say that this has had a corrosive effect inside the Western press like no other war that I've seen. People have different opinions about the war in Ukraine, but you don't see this kind of divisive, corrosive, vitriolic splits that have opened up. Just the other day, there was an open letter complaining about, signed by 100 BBC people, BBC staff, complaining about BBC's lack of balance and the fact that it's not applying rigorous evidential criteria to reporting on this conflict. And there are many sort of taboos. If you see an interviewee on the BBC talking about the genocide, you can see a visible wincing from the presenter. So there's this kind of inside. There's been ructions inside the BBC. The New York Times did a piece about how Hamas was weaponizing rape as a weapon of war, which again the evidence really isn't there. And when that was taken apart, it was just seemed to be not in line with the New York Times' normal standards. So this caused ructions. Even the Jewish Chronicle, which was a highly respected, 150-year-old newspaper for the Jewish community. It ran a whole series of 10 articles by somebody who turned out to be quite a phony, and the articles themselves were planted probably by Netanyahu's office or by Mossad or whichever, but which reflected a bit of a struggle going on inside the Israeli leadership. And a lot of very good journalists actually walked out. Jonathan Friedland and others walked out because they didn't want to be associated with that standard of journalism. So there's been this sort of extraordinary rifts opening up within the journalistic community in the West, which has never happened before, as far as I'm aware. Quite extraordinary. I'd like just to end by reading out to show the effect this whole thing has had on inside Israel itself, which is vitally important. I mean, what happens in the West may not be that important. But I just want to read something that I found really, really revealing. It's by Professor Omer Bartov. I don't know if that name means anything to anybody. He's a professor of Holocaust and genocide studies, Israeli-born, served in the IDF, etc., in the October War, and in the West Bank and in Gaza and so on. So he knows where he's coming from. He's Israeli. But he's been outside the country. He came back. He hadn't been in Israel since the previous June. He came back this June, and he was shocked to find the changes that had taken place in Israeli society since he left. He said there were two main conclusions he came to about the mentality now prevailing. He said the first is a combination of rage and fear, a desire to reestablish security at any cost, and a complete distrust of political solutions, negotiations, and reconciliation. The second is the utter inability of Israeli society today to feel any empathy for the population of Gaza. The majority, it seems, don't even want to know what's happening in Gaza, and this desire is reflected in TV coverage. Israeli television news these days usually begins with the reports on the funerals of soldiers, invariably described as heroes, fallen in the fighting in Gaza, followed by estimates of how many Hamas fighters were liquidated. References to Palestinian civilian deaths are rare and normally presented as part of enemy propaganda or as a cause for unwelcome international pressure. The scale of what's being perpetrated in Gaza right now by the IDF is as unprecedented as the complete indifference of most Israelis to what is being done in their name. The way people's eyes glaze over whenever one mentions the suffering of Palestinian civilians, the deaths of thousands of children and women and elderly people, is deeply unsettling. The impression I got was consistent. We have no room in our hearts. We have no room in our thoughts. We do not want to speak about or to be shown what our own soldiers, our children or grandchildren, our brothers and sisters are doing right now in Gaza. We must focus on ourselves, on our trauma, fear and anger. So that is really worrying to me. It shows how Israeli society as a whole has been, and the peace camp has been decimated. The peace camp in Israel virtually doesn't exist. There are a few brave voices being raised, but, you know, a lot of them are actually trying to get out of the country because they find they find the atmosphere toxic and unbearable. And this is allowing Israeli politics and politicians, Netanyahu and Ben-Gvir and these people, to basically lead in directions which wouldn't have been possible before. So given this huge gulf, I mean, on the Arab side also, you're not going to find many Palestinians or Arabs who are going to feel like extending a hand to the Israelis after what's been happening in Gaza. If ever there was a need for somebody like Ian Black with his deep understanding of both sides in this conflict, it's now. The Iranians have a phrase for when they're missing somebody. It's, your place is empty, Jat Khaliyeh. I would say, Ian, your place is really very, very empty now. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question. Like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Okay, as I said at the start, we do have a reception outside that begins half past. So we've got a... It's fine. The conversation can continue. But we'll just have a try and get perhaps at least one round of questions. I'll take three questions initially. I'm sure I can't get everybody, but if you ask a question, could you please? We invite you to introduce yourself. Keep your questions short and your comments even shorter, please. Okay, here first. Yes. Please wait for the microphone to come to you. Yeah.
Thank you very much. My name is Camilla. I'm in the School of Public Policy. First of all, thank you so much for tonight. It was very insightful and lovely to hear from you. My question is very directed as you as a journalist, because one of the things I've been wondering about is, and you just mentioned it in the end, is accountability among journalists and among all these news outlets. And I mean, the beheaded baby stories is just one of many among big news outlets that have been turned out to be wrong or, you know, not based on fully accurate claims. Why is there no accountability, or is there nothing? Why do some of these news outlets not come out, you know, and apologize or, like, you know, issue statements on saying that this was wrong? Because in a way, I think it would help a lot. You're saying, you know, Netanyahu is still making a lot of statements, references to a lot of these claims that were initially verified by outlets, but now they're no longer seen to be true.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thanks. Just hold there. Yeah. For the okay. Two more. We'll take one from this section here. So I'm making the person with the microphone run around at the front. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is John Andrews, formerly of The Economist. Jim, we have known each other since Cambridge in the 1960s, and you came to Beirut and stayed with us for several weeks.
I remember.
In
thank
1975.
You, John, yes.
thank you very much for this sobering presentation. I think in those days, we shared a certain kind of excitement about the Middle East. I'm just wondering, after your 50 years covering the Middle East, in general, and also in particular the Arab-Israeli conflict, what is your overriding emotion? Is it despair? Is it anger? Is there ever any space for hope? I mean, personally, I find very little space for that, but I just...
You've answered the question, John.
Well, we'll hold it for the moment. And this side, halfway up. Thank you.
I'm going to have to remember these questions.
Mike Cushman, formerly of this parish, but now retired. Thank you very much, Jim, for a very evocative description of what it's like on the ground. What I'm interested in is what happens when he gets back to London. I remember a few years ago listening to Jeremy Bowen in another lecture theatre on this floor, talking about the pressures on BBC journalists about what they were and were not allowed to say, and the framing of the discussion, which he felt very, very constrained by. I mean, that must have been 4 or 5 years ago, I think. Do you think it's got better? Do you think it's got worse?
Thank you. Okay, so we'll take those three questions.
Okay.
Do you want me to...
I think I've probably more or less got it now, thanks. Coming to your question about accountability and so on, I think part of the problem in the West is that the whole thing played into an existing kind of psychosis about the issue of anti-Semitism. You had the kerfuffle in the Labour Party, Corbyn and all the rest of it, and I think the Israelis were quite successful in conflating criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism, which to me are totally different things, you know, obviously. But people are terrified of being accused of being anti-Semitic. So I think that goes a long way towards explaining why there's extreme nervousness, and you can see it in BBC coverage and things, of talking about, for example, none of the major organizations like the BBC have done a proper forensic in-depth investigation into what actually did happen on the 7th of October. So, there's a lot of very soft questioning going on. It was a radio program where the Israeli ambassador was given a totally free ride, no pushback at all, coming out with all the stuff we know about. Whereas the next day, the Lebanese ambassador was constantly interrupted, saying with cries of, you know, Hezbollah is firing rockets into Israel, in response to everything he was trying to say. It shouldn't really be like that. There should be much more, you know, strict questioning and pushback on both sides, you know, not just on one side. But I think it's partly because it does play into this anti-Semitic kind of phobia that people have, that you can't, there are some topics that are just so delicate that you just got to steer away from them. I think that's basically the problem. Yeah. Now coming to the other one, John, there you are. Yes, my overwhelming. I'm depressed. I'm angry. I don't see a lot of hope, to be honest, because this thing hasn't run its course either. We don't know where it's going. I said at the beginning, I think, that it's existential for both sides. You know, it could be. I've seen articles from Jewish Israelis saying this could be the end of Zionism, you know, but lots of people saying, you know, the most likely thing is the Palestinians get shoved out of the West Bank and out of Gaza, and, you know, from the river to the sea will be purely Jewish Israeli, you know. And we don't know which way it's going to go. I mean, we're talking about a two-state solution, but is that viable at this stage when you've got 600,000 settlers? You know, is a one-state solution, can kind of Arabs and Jews living together in a one state after everything that's happened and the kind of vitriolic polarization that's taken place? What is the solution apart from that? I mean, shove the Palestinians out and say bad luck. I'll just read you a little, like carry a few quotes around with me because they're so meaningful. That won't take more than 10 minutes, that's all right. I carry very, very few around just for occasions like this. And now I've lost it. It'll come back. Where are you? It's a quote from, it's actually a tweet from the Prime Minister of Israel's office in 2018. And it kind of tells me a lot about what's in the head. This is Prime Minister of Israel at Israel PM, August 29, 2018. This is a spontaneous tweet. The weak crumble, are slaughtered, and are erased from history, while the strong, for good or for ill, survive. The strong are respected, and alliances are made with the strong, and in the end, peace is made with the strong. So, I mean, you put that into the current context, it doesn't look good for future peace, really, does it? I mean, is Israel going to be a kind of warrior state constantly fighting in order to keep up this kind of feeling that you're constantly under attack, you have to mobilize against the enemy? Or, I mean, one would like to think that this would push the Israelis towards a realization that actually peace has to involve talking to people, making peace with your enemies, not imposing it on them as a crushed, subjugated nation. So I don't know. It's very difficult to feel cheerful and optimistic, put it that way. I blame the Americans as much as the Israelis, to be honest, because they enable everything and control nothing. Yeah. There we are. Oh, sorry. Now we're talking about pressure on BBC journalists. I have to admit, I haven't been doing regular news stuff. I've been off the staff since 2006, so I can't talk about the recent situation. But in my 35, 40 years working for the BBC, I never felt any pressure to write things differently. I was aware that I was reporting in an extremely contentious situation. That doesn't mean you self-center. It means that you are aware that you may have to defend every word that you speak and every word that you write. But I never felt any pressure, and I've never been censored by the BBC. So, yeah, I can't speak from personal experience that I was, you know, maybe pressured not to say this or to say that. Maybe now, in the current, you know, highly toxic situation, it might be different. You can't say the word genocide or whatever. I don't know. But in my own experience, the BBC has been absolutely fine. So I'm sorry I can't say anything more provocative than that.
Good, thank you. I mean, normally we might extend for some more questions, but as we have the reception starting now outside and the conversation can continue there, I think we'll stop there. I want to thank, firstly, thanks to my LSE colleagues for organising this event, particularly Nadine Amanasfi, who's the events manager, engagement officer, manager of the LSE Middle East Centre. Thanks to you, the audience, for turning up. Thank you for the questions that we did have. And I think we've had a very, very fitting inaugural lecture there, which embodies the spirit that Ian Black represented in terms of its dispassionate, but also very, very insightful, evidence-informed analysis. So please, can you join me in thanking Jim for his wonderful lecture?
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.